This is the Entree Architect Podcast, episode 93. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. Last week on the podcast, I shared my 12 steps to business success in architecture. That's the same presentation I shared at the recent AIA CRAN Symposium. And if you haven't listened to that, go back, entrearchitect.com/episode92 and listen to that. I share a lot of what I talk about on the podcast, and a lot of what I write on the blog. It's everything you need to know to be successful. And I proposed that if you learned how to execute on each of the 12 steps, you would be a successful architect with a profitable business, leading you to create more art and better architecture. This week, we're continuing where I left off last week. We're going to go deeper. We're going to get more practical, and we're going to discuss what it takes to be a successful small business, whether you're running an ice cream stand, a manufacturing company, or an architecture firm. This week on the Entree Architect Podcast, I'm speaking with CEO of Crown Point Cabinetry, Brian Stowell, and we discussed the anatomy of a successful small business. This episode of the Entree Architect Podcast is sponsored by ArcaSnapper, a great way to create and manage field reports. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/ArcaSnapper. And FreshBooks, the easiest way to send invoices, manage expenses, and track your time. Learn more at freshbooks.com/architect. Brian Stowell, welcome to the Entree Architect Podcast.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you here. I've been hoping to have this conversation for a long time. You are a leader at Crown Point Cabinetry up in New Hampshire. And as an architect here in Westchester County, New York, we're the owners of Five Cat Studio. We've talked about Five Cat Studio quite a bit on the podcast. But Crown Point has always been a great partner for us. And I wanted to make sure with the audience that they understand that this podcast is not a commercial for Crown Point, but I wanted to sort of invite you guys to come and talk to us about a successful business. Last week, I put together a podcast on the 12 steps to business success in architecture, and I broke down the fundamentals of business. And what I wanted to do today is look at Crown Point because of the great experience that we've had over a decade now. We've done over a dozen kitchens with you. You have a great product. You have superior customer service. And I love the fact that you're a family-owned business. And so I wanted to hear from you how you make that all work. How do you make me as an architect and my clients, make my clients happy and make me as an architect look good? It's really how it comes down.
It's easy to make you look good, but other architects, sometimes we've run into some stumbling blocks, but the architectural community as a whole, we're very happy to work with. But thank you for the kind words. I will do this very briefly. This business was started in the garage by my dad about 38 years ago. At one point, he had mom and all seven of us kids working for him. And people used to say, oh, you guys must fight like cats and dogs. And the answer is no, we never fought like cats and dogs. And dad always made sure we were too busy. And mom was always there to listen when we as younger kids whined about how hard we were working. But I credit my dad. I credit my mom. And when you talked about stellar customer service, that was my dad. He taught us how important it was to go above and beyond when you're working with somebody. And really, I mean, everything that we do here comes from the foundation that he laid, almost 40 years ago.
So. Oh, that's fantastic. What I'd like to do is use Crown Point as a case study and basically, discuss the anatomy of a successful small business, because I've always talked about architecture firms as small businesses, that what we're doing, although we're artists, many of us feel that the art comes first. My argument is that profit should come first, and then the art, you'll have a lot more time to do the art. And so what I'd like to do is start with sort of your origin story. Talk about the history of Crown Point and give us a background on how it started and how you got to where you are today.
Okay. Yeah. I when you talk about profits coming first, I laugh because we had nonprofit down with science. But my dad basically was very talented with his hands. And when he was 18 years old, to give you an idea, he built his first home. And I said, "Dad, how'd you know how to do that?" And he said, "I bought a book." And I'm thinking, I could have an encyclopedia and not be able to build a house, but that's another story. But he was just always very good at it. And he was a teacher and a principal for many, many, many years. And because he had seven kids, he used to work nights and weekends to make sure that we were all fed. Of course, Mom worked third shift to do her part. Let me be clear on that. And he got to the point where he was enjoying the fine woodworking portion of construction more than being out on job sites and that kind of thing. So he decided that he was going to build a kitchen for somebody that was local. And it came out really nice, and somebody else asked him to build one, and it got to the point where he said, I think I'd rather be doing this. And so he found a local dealer in town to display his product, and the rest, as they say, is history. But that's how the business basically got started. But at one point we're in the garage, and I use the term garage. It wasn't really a garage that you'd park a car in. It was an old Victorian house that you could see through the boards of the great outdoors. We heated it with a wood stove. Not the best idea when you're spraying finish in a garage with a wood stove, but all the things we went through when we were younger. But it was just it really, more than anything else, it wasn't, he didn't have a grand plan, he would tell you, other than to feed the family and do something that he enjoyed. So that was the beginning of the business. And as we grew, more and more family members came into the business. And we eventually got to the point where we said, okay, we've got to have a little bit more organized structure. And I would say it was probably, we had grown to the point where we had about 75 dealers throughout New England, a couple in New York. The 1990 recession really hammered us hard, and we literally, we had family meetings every day because we weren't making any money, and we're like, okay, are we going to keep the business afloat? Are we going to go out of business? How are we going to make things work? And I mean, I remember meeting distinctly with Mom and Dad where they sat down with us and said, look, here's the deal. We took our last $10,000 out of savings. Dad was just about my age. And he said, we did that to cover payroll, and we're expecting some money this week. But if we don't get it, then we're going to be in trouble. But by law, we pay the employees first. And because you're kids, you get paid second, and your mother and I get paid third. There's a possibility we pay you and you can't cash your check. We would tell you that. And your mother and I can go about a month, and then we're in trouble, and then we're completely done. So that was, those memories are as fresh as yesterday. And we had some discussions about how to make ends meet and things we could cut. And I learned a lot about what made a business tick back then. And it was a very difficult time for us. But it was also a time where and my dad was very fiscally conservative. He didn't want to borrow money, which was great. But I can remember thinking to myself, this is not a lot of fun, and we could find a way to make money. So I convinced my dad to let me make some changes on the floor. I let him make some changes with how we approached the employees. Meaning, they liked working for us. They felt we were honest. But, we just couldn't provide him a lot.
Yeah.
And I sat down and said, here's what I want to do. And he was great. He said, I think you're naive, but if you want to try these things, he said, I will support you. He said, if you want to spend money, you got to come see me, because he said, we really don't have any. And so I said, okay. So I, he said, the last thing was, look, I don't think it's going, I don't think it can go a lot better. And it's, you know, it's manufacturing, it's work. That's the way it is. Nobody gets rich. And he said, I'm not unhappy with how production runs. He said, that's your brother's jurisdiction. So you want to make all these changes. I will support it as long as your brother supports it. He said, I wouldn't let him go in and change sales, because you're in charge of sales. I wouldn't let him go and charge sales without your permission. So you go see him to see if you can make the changes on the floor. I said, okay, all right, I appreciate that. So I went to see my brother, Jeff, and I said, I'm all excited. I tell him all the changes I want to make. And he looks at me kind of blankly, and he says, you want to do my job? And I said, well, it's not that I want to do your job, but I think we need to make some changes so that we have a chance at making money. And, you know, our employee retention was terrible. We had 300 W-2s at the end of the year, and we had 100 employees. You know, what's that tell you, Mark? So I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, in all honesty, Brian, he said, I'd love to have you do my job. Dad picked me because I was the oldest. I don't enjoy this job. It's nothing that I ever wanted to do. I feel like I babysit 100 people. And if you want my help, tell me. If you want me to stay off the floor, tell me. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do. He said, I'm worn out. So I said, okay. So I went out and I thanked him. I went out on the shop floor and I shut the entire shop down. And I stood up on a table and I said, things changed today. I said, I know people like us and they feel we're honest and hardworking, but it's my theory that we don't focus on quality first. It goes out the door, people are happy, but I think we're building every custom kitchen twice.
What year was this, Brian?
Right around 1990.
And when did your dad start in the garage?
1978.
Okay. So from 1978 to 1990, you grew out of the garage into a factory, essentially.
Yeah, Dad's first year, he did 35,000 in sales. Then the next year, 114. The next year, 315. The next year, 495. The next year, 995. The next year, 1.5 million. So we were on a pretty strong growth curve, because you're building custom cabinetry, Mark, at that point.
Right, and then the recession hit. And took a big chunk out of everything.
Yeah, really threw us for a loop, and we weren't prepared for it.
Yeah, and so, we've just recently gone through a massive recession, and so a lot of architects listening can certainly relate to all of that. So what did you do at that point? You stood up on you shut everything down, you stood up on the bench, and you said, you know, we're going to make some changes in order to survive this. So what did you do?
Well, I said the first thing we're going to do is we're going to focus on quality first. Because we don't, I said, I swear we build every kitchen twice. And if you don't understand quality, then we will teach it to you. If you refuse, if you already know quality, we're going to ask you to help teach it to people. If you refuse to learn quality, then we're going to ask you to work somewhere else. And if you can't, and this would be the most painful, if you can't learn quality, then we're going to tell you we appreciate your energies, but we're going to say it's not a good fit for you. So basically, we had situations where literally we were paying people to redo something that one of their other members of, they weren't teams at the time, but other members of the department were doing. So we were just working to keep ourselves employed, and there's no money in that.
Was there a definition to quality? Did they know what that meant?
Not really, no. So we had to define that, because there were too many ideas as to what was acceptable.
Right.
And that was not a place where we were going to be successful until we could get that defined. And it wasn't an easy process, but I told them, I said, look, here's the deal. We don't make any money because we waste too much labor and materials, not your fault, ours. But I'm going to make you a deal. I'm going to get off this table and I'm going to every department and I'm going to ask you to make one change that I think is just a waste of time, energy, and money. And when that's successful, we'll make more money. And then I'm going to ask you to do something else. And then when that's successful, we're going to make more money. I'm going to ask you to do something else. But all along the way, I'm going to share it with you. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to buy donuts every morning for people so that they understand I'm going first. And you could say, well, I thought we'd have money for donuts. Well, we will as soon as we stop wasting some of the stuff that I'm going to ask you to stop doing. And what happened was we, and I hate to use the term because it's so overused, but we empowered the people that work in here to come to us to make change, to be an important part of the process. And, you know, we unleashed the greatest amount of ideas and improvements. It was mind-numbing in all honesty.
That's so important to give the power to the people, like you say. I mean, it's essentially giving them ownership of their role, of their position, so they can be proud of what they do and find ways to do it better.
Yeah, because the truth of the matter is, it really doesn't matter what business you're in. I don't care if you're in the ice cream cone business where you're making ice creams during the summer for people. There are improvements that can be made, but as the owner or the president or the boss, you don't know what all of them are. You're not out there every day. And I got to a point where I said, look, I want every person that works for me to come up with a list of 10 things that they would change if they were in charge. Now, please be serious about this. Don't write down, pay myself $1 million a year. That's not a constructive suggestion. So when I'm asking you to come up with suggestions, what changes would you make in what you do every day? Maybe stuff that's provided to you, maybe vendors that we've picked that don't work out well for what you're trying to build. We want to hear it all. I was so buried with the suggestions, it was unbelievable. And I got to the point where we had to triage the suggestions because there were too many of them coming in at the same time. And I don't want to give you the idea that we were the world's messiest company. We weren't. But when you've got 93 people and you build custom product, there are a lot of things that go on that just kind of, you know, morph over time into something that's not very helpful for contributing to the bottom line. And we found out that most of the time, it wasn't the employees that were doing a bad job. It was we had asked them to do things that were not completely feasible. As an example, I can remember a Pine Kitchen that got sent back from finishing twice to what was then known as the sanding department. And I was frustrated. I'm like, God, can't they sand this right? So I went out to sand it myself. And I said, there, now I know it's right. We stained it and had the same problem. We had provided the wrong grit paper to the people in the sanding department. And we didn't realize it. So, you know, I was fortunate in that I was smart enough not to stand up and say, a lot of you guys are killing me. So, you know, there are going to be some heads rolling because I'd have had to roll my head first. But it was amazing the things that you learned that you had no idea were going on, and people just tolerated it because they're like, well, they want us to do this, so we're going to do it.
Right.
And once you ask them, what holds you up from being successful? What slows you down from doing a good job? What prevents you from building quality? It's amazing what people will tell you. And you think to yourself, oh, they're going to just come out and tell you anyway. They really don't, because they're thinking, these are the rules. This is the company. This is how they want things done. So this is how we'll do it.
Yeah. They don't want to make waves. They just want to get their job done and get paid.
Yeah, exactly. And I got to tell you, we went from, we had 90, close to 100 employees. But we had, in about 6 months, we went from 73 that built cabinetry out of those 90 something down to about 47 that built cabinetry, and we were building more product.
Because you became more efficient through the changes suggested.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, this is the God's honest truth. We really weren't building the average kitchen twice before it went out the door. We were building it about three times. and it was, you know, that's why we didn't make any money.
So were there specific systems that you put in place after you received all of that information from your employees?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The systems that we have today. Now I say that, but I have to add but we're not done. I mean, I've got two meetings this afternoon with two different groups of teams to say, how can we improve the order processing that we do every day? Because if we're going to continue to get better, we've got to sit down and knock our heads together and say, you know, what's working well, what's not.
Right. So 25 years later, you're still improving the systems.
Yeah. And we'll improve them until I can't walk anymore.
Would you say that systems, you know, as a bottom line, that's what changed Crown Point from that struggling company to a successful company? Is this establishing
systems? What changed was making sure the employees knew how important they were in the process.
So that's the priority.
That was it.
To empower the employees and make sure they understand how valued they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Because what we found was there were a lot of employees that we sold short. These are all true confessions, Mark. You would look at an employee and say, oh, they're not capable of this. Really? Why don't you find out? You know, don't let them go out and fly a jumbo jet with 400 people on board. That's not what I'm talking about. But you would be amazed how much people really can do when they're given the opportunity. You know, everybody's got their ceiling. I've got my ceiling. You shouldn't make those judgments as, oh, this person's only capable of this. I've worked with them, so I know they're only capable of this. When you unleash somebody's potential, it's really exciting as to what can be accomplished. I'll tell you that the biggest change to make that happen was my wife, who she's the smarter of the two of us. She's the college educated one. She came in and converted the departments to teams. And everybody's like, oh, we're a team. Well, I'll give you an idea what our teams are. Our teams, I tell people, oh, yeah, I'm so important. I sign the paychecks, but I'm so unimportant, I can't hire anybody. I'm not allowed to hire somebody and put them on the door team. I'm not allowed to hire somebody and put them on one of the teams because I don't work on those teams. So I'm not, I guess the only person I could ever hire would be a personal assistant, and I'm not going to do that. So the teams... My sister's human resource manager. She'll do pre-interviews and say, I think this might be a good fit for this team if the team is looking for somebody. But the teams actually interview and hire the employees. And then they train them. And then they review them. And then they're responsible for their raises. They're also responsible for discipline, should there be any. I don't want to make it sound like we hope to discipline people. We hope not to. But these teams meet every day, every morning for a meeting to discuss the day's production, the day's requirements, any issues that they might have, whether or not they've got somebody out, whether or not they've got some help, they can go help somebody else, a different team. I have people that come in here, different business owners, they'll come in and they'll sit in on my team meetings and they'll be like, where did you find these people? I don't even go into the meetings. My brother-in-law is in charge of all the cabinet making teams, so he's the one that sits in on the meetings. I said, well, they're just people that we gave them the opportunity to excel. And they're like, man, we wish we had employees like that. And I said, well, it's not like we grow them out back in a garden. You know, these are people that you hire and you train them on the system and you give them the opportunity to contribute. And you'd be surprised what you can get out of people. Now, that being said, you better make sure they know how much you love them. You better make sure they know how much you appreciate them, and you better make sure you share with them. And when I say that, my wife and I instituted a gain sharing program, which when we started, I told the employees, my goal is to have you get paid for overtime and not work it. And we instituted a program where we say, here's the budget for this particular job. And if you guys don't spend it, we're going to set it aside. And we track it weekly, after 4 weeks, if there's money left over, then what happens is we will pay that out to you because we were going to spend it anyway. And what it does is it promotes cooperation, helping each other's teams, cross-training, looking out for each other. I could go on and on. And we've had that gain-sharing program for, just about since 1992, 93. And during the darkest days after 08, we went, 4 years without any gain sharing because I had more employees than work. Last period, the gain sharing was 19%, which means basically work 4 weeks, get paid for five. And the employees, but my point is not, oh, aren't I generous? No, the point is the employees generated it. So they get to keep it. So they get excited by it. And every day they how are we doing? How are we doing? But once again, I want them to be vested in our success, something that they can see they directly contribute to.
Right, and they and that that reinforces that value, that that ownership, the feeling of ownership, and encourages them to work harder and make more improvements and make a higher quality product.
Yeah, and you know, before all this started, when there were departments, there were departments that used to laugh at other departments that had to work Friday. You know, we work 4 10-hour days because that's what the employees want to do. And I told them, as long as you can continue to work safely and build quality, I don't care if you work 4 10s and have 3 day weekends. But if we've got a safety issue or a quality issue, then we'll go back to the 5 8s, which we have not had. But there used to be departments before they were teams that used to laugh at the other departments that had to work on Fridays or even Saturdays because they thought it was funny. And that sounds cruel, but that's honest. And it was very disrespectful, but it happened. And now with gain sharing, all of the teams, they don't want other teams to come in and work overtime. They don't, because if somebody comes and works overtime, then the payroll goes up and then there's nothing left over for gain sharing. So they want to know, is there a reason why people are having to work Friday? Can they go over and help? Can they do something? Is there something they're doing that's preventing them from being more successful? It's an ongoing, we're all in this together thought process.
I want to take a quick break here to say thank you to Arcasnapper and FreshBooks for their support as platform sponsors of Entree Architect. As a platform sponsor, Arcasnapper and FreshBooks has provided funding and support for our overall mission to become an influential force in the profession of architecture. They recognize the need for small firms to build better businesses in order to be better architects. Arcasnapper is a simple tool for creating and managing field reports. With Arcasnapper, architects can draft reports on site using their phone or tablet. Arcasnapper is easy to use and saves a ton of time. Grow your business instead of struggling with field reports. If you want to learn more about Arcasnapper, and you should, you can get a free 30-day trial at entrearchitect.com/Arcasnapper. And FreshBooks is the easy-to-use invoicing software designed to help small firm owners get organized, save time invoicing, and get paid faster. It takes care of invoicing, expense tracking, estimating, reporting, and it all happens in the cloud. So you have access for your information from anywhere you have access to the internet. It saves time, it helps you get paid faster, and it's easy and convenient. To access your free 30-day trial of FreshBooks, go to freshbooks.com/architect and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. So you do have systems, obviously. And so are the systems documented in a manual? How when somebody's brought in as a new team member, how are they trained?
They're trained by their team members.
But is there a standard on which they're basing that training?
If you ask me to provide a big book with all of those procedures, I would tell you that's an area where we lack. Mm-hmm. What we do is we've got so many people that see, once again, another true confession, Mark. We've got so many people that are trained on the different systems out there. People are always trained the same way.
Right.
So not all of the systems are documented. Are some of them? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But if you said to me, is every single one of them documented? I'd say, no, that's a true confession. We're working on that.
Yeah. Because I mean, the experience that I've had has been very consistent, even through, because we've worked now with 3 separate designers over the last decade plus.
Right.
And one of the great things is that we are assigned a designer. And so when we work with Crown Point, we work with that same person each time. And then they've moved on and we've gotten a new one. And we've worked with them and then they've retired and have moved on. And now we're on our third one. Each time has been a very, very positive and very consistent process. So clearly they're following some, whether it's trained or whether it's in a manual, some sort of process that shows them how to do what they do.
Yeah, I will tell you, I appreciate you mentioning that. You worked with Christine, who was terrific.
Right, yep.
And she retired.
Yep.
And you worked with
Carol.
Carol, who was terrific, and she retired. My goal here is to, once I hire people, not have them leave me.
Yeah.
And when they retire, I stand up and I cry and wish them well and thank them for what they've done. But we don't have a lot of turnover, especially sales. The reason you're on your third is because of retirements,
right.
But I can tell you one of the things I didn't mention in all this was the reason why we sell direct. And the reason why we work directly with you and your clients.
Right. And so originally you talked about dealers.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So tell me where that transition happened.
Well, we once again did it the way everybody else did it. If you wanted to be a millwork shop or a custom cabinet maker that people retailed your product, if you will, you would go find a home center or a kitchen store and say, would you carry my line? And we were successful in finding 75s, 76, 77 at the time, different dealers in different locations that if there was somebody in that area, that's who they, a prospect, a client, that's who they would deal with. And when the recession came around, we were trying to figure out ways to get dealers to sell more product. And my dad would say to me, how's it going? And I'd say, struggling, but we're working on it. And I can remember going into a dealer that won't be named. And there were two very nice women that worked there. And my brother and I had teamed up to go out and see if we could wrangle up some more business. And we said, how's it going? Oh, bad, really, really bad. This was the 90 recession. And I said, yeah, it's been tough. We could tell you that ourselves. And they said, see that desk calendar there? They had one of the big desk calendars. I said, yeah. They said, see those X's on the days? And I said, yeah. They said, we put an X for every day that nobody comes in the showroom. And I said, yeah, that looks like you don't have a lot of showroom traffic. I said, well, I just spent a pile of money on a planning guide for professional designers, which was basically architects. So I said, have you contacted any architects in your area to let them know that you'd like to stop by and drop it off and tell them what Crown Point's up to? And they said, no, there's no point in it. And I said, what do you mean there's no point in it? And they said, nobody's doing anything. And I said, well, somebody's doing something. The whole world hasn't come to a stop. Oh, no, it really has. I said, so I just spent a lot of money on these. You don't want to, they cost you guys like nothing. All you've got to do is go out and introduce them to the architects and drop them off. And no, there's really no point in it. So I walked out of that dealership with my brother and I said, we've hooked our future to these guys' wagons.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I had, in a six-month time frame, I had three phone calls from three different individuals that had owned Crown Point before, but had moved to like Baltimore, Maryland, and other locations where we didn't have a dealer, and said, hey, we had Crown Point before. And we would like to do Crown Point again. Where's your dealer down here? And I said, oh, we don't have a dealer down there. And they're like, oh, that's too bad. I said, yeah, I'm really sorry about that, but thanks for thinking of us. They said, no problem. So my dad would say, did we sell anything today? And I said, no, but I did tell somebody to go away. And he said, yeah, I'm sure you did. And I said, no, they moved and blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, that's too bad. I said, yeah. At the same time this is happening, I get three phone calls. Once again, everything happens in threes, I guess, over probably a five-month period. Two women that were crying, one man that was yelling at me. And I'm like, I picked up the phone and, this is Brian. Can I help you? Because they wanted to talk to the guy in charge. And they were very upset that Crown Point, they said Crown Point hadn't shipped what they were supposed to ship. And they were sick of us lying to them. And they're, when was it going to end? And I'm like, tell me who you are. Let me get to the bottom of this, find out what's going on. In all three cases, it was dealers that were on COD because they owed me a lot of money. And it was like molding or a filler or something small. And they didn't order it from me because they just figured the customer would go away. And they didn't have money to pay me, I guess, is what they had decided. So they kept telling the customer that Crown Point had basically keep saying it's going to be shipped and it's not being shipped. So I apologized to all of them. I ship them what they're looking for at no cost because I had selected the dealers. I felt they were my responsibility. So I sat down with my brother and my father and I said, let me get this right. We have customers that are now saying bad things about us because dealers have lied about us. We have dealers that don't want to go out and find business because they figure the world has come to an end. And we've got people calling us that want product that we can't sell to because we don't have a dealer in that area. And we're trying to figure out whether or not we're going to stay in business. What's wrong with this picture? So I put together a plan where we were going to work directly outside of the dealer territory, because you give somebody a word, you don't break it. This wasn't to replace the dealers. This was outside the dealer territory. And I put together a plan and I presented it to my dad. And I said, okay, here's what I want to do. I want to sell direct outside the dealer territory. We'll keep the dealer business, but hopefully this will supplement it. And, you know, here's how it's going to work, blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, let me think about it. So I come back every day. If you, yes, yes, yes. He said, well, let me sit down and tell you 10 reasons why it won't work. And they're all legitimate reasons. Probably six of them I haven't thought of. So he's asking me what I would do in that instance. And I kept making up an answer on the fly because I was still convinced I could do it. And finally, he said, you know, he said stuff like, you know, what happens if a builder calls and said it was damaged? You have a door that was damaged, but he didn't note it on delivery. I said, I give him a new door. He said, aren't you worried that they're just going to damage stuff and we're going to pay for it? I said, yeah, it can happen. But I think, you know, most people are honest. So I don't think they're going to do that to us on a major scale. He said, well, what happens, you know, when, you know, the measurements aren't right? And I said, well, we'll develop a system so that it's very, very tough to get the measurements wrong. But he said, but what if they say, hey, that wasn't the measurement and we need a new cabinet? And I said, well, we'll give them a new cabinet. He said, aren't you concerned about being ripped off? I said, not really. I guess maybe, but no. And he finally gets to the end and he said, I think if it was such a good idea, I think it's fraught with peril, he said. But I think if it was such a good idea, somebody else would be doing it by now. And he said, how much do you think it would cost to get off the ground? And I said, about $100,000. Well, Mark, I might as well have told him $100 million, because I mean, literally, we didn't have any money. So he said, okay, well, here's the deal. You're still convinced you can make it work? I said, yeah, I'm absolutely convinced. That's what youth will do for you. And he said, well, here's the deal. We'll go down to the bank. He said, we'll go to the bank, and if you can convince them to lend us the money, then we'll try it. Otherwise, he said, I think we're done. I said, okay, can we go now? He said, no, Brian, you need to make an appointment with the bank. I said, okay. So we call the bank, and we're going to meet them the next day. I go down there, and I do my pitch, and they summarize it this way. So let's get this right, Brian. You want us to lend you $100,000 basically unsecured, because right now you owe us money for a mortgage on a building that is worth less than what the mortgage is. You aren't making money, you're not sure if you're going to stay in business, and you want to do something nobody else has ever done. I said, yes, that's all correct. And they said, yeah, we'll get back to you. So they called the next day, we'll lend you the money. So the bank had faith in me, and they lent me the money. And I can tell you that although the program has changed just like everything else in here, it became so successful that we got to the point where we said, we can't have dealers and direct, because I would get phone calls, Mark. Somebody call, hey, my sister got a kitchen from you. She came up and toured. She loved it. It's beautiful. It's everything she wanted. She's really excited. I'm doing a house. I want to do the same thing. I said, great. So can I work with you? Absolutely. Where do you live? We live in, you know, Wolfboro, New Hampshire. I said, I've got a dealer there. They said, well, what does that mean? I said, you will go to the dealer. Well, I don't want to go to the dealer.
Yeah.
I said, they're a great dealer. Fantastic people, some of the nicest people you've met. Yeah, but why can't I deal directly with you? And I said, because I have a dealer relationship in your area, and I gave my word. Well, is it going to cost me more money? I said, well, a little, you know, but they're going to hold your hand and help you pick out countertops and faucets and that kind of stuff. And they said, yeah, we don't want that. We want to do what my sister did. So now I was running into a problem where I was literally telling people to go away that wanted to buy directly from me. So what we did was, dealer relationships were kind of like boyfriends and girlfriends when you're younger. You know, when you first meet them, you're like, you're so infatuated and you're going to be in love forever. And then not that far down the road, you're like, yeah, we're not that compatible. So you break up and a new one comes along until you meet your wife. And I got down to the point where I had separated from about 68 out of the 73 dealers. And I had five of them left that were really terrific, like the one in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, just fantastic people. And I finally had to go to them and say, look, I felt terrible. Literally, it sounded like this. You've been the perfect wife. I'm leaving you. Because they'd never done me wrong, but I couldn't advertise direct nationally. I kept telling people, no, I can't do something in your area. And it just became too much. So we picked we picked one method, which was selling direct, and we've never looked back. But based on that, we have to run the tightest ship because, Mark, you're close by compared to some of my customers. If you ship custom, you will do whole house projects in California. It will cost me more money because I don't charge for shipping. It'll cost me more money to ship a cabinet than what a cabinet costs if we make a mistake. So when you talk about how people are really good with the order process and it's all the same, that's a result of us learning the hard way that you just cannot let stuff happen that you could let stuff happen when you had a dealer. You're like, oh, the dealer run out, take care of it. You know, you just can't do that. So that's where a lot of the tight quality control came from. That was selling direct. So.
Yeah, it's all of these changes that you made are exactly why we like working with you, because when we have had issues, because every project has issues.
Sure.
Not every kitchen has had issues, but you know every architecture project has issues, and occasionally we've had some issues where something got dinged in the truck or whatever. I've never ever had pushback. I've called you guys and you've just replaced it. And so clearly that's a policy. And that's why we keep working with you. And when people ask me who I recommend, that's why I recommend you, because that's how you guys make us look good, is that when there's an issue, that issue's resolved. That's what separates you, I think, from most of the other cabinet companies, even the local dealers, that you don't go away after you get paid. You're just as available as you were before you got paid, and very many other local dealers, once they get paid, it's very difficult to get them back.
My premise is that it may sound corny, but it's the golden rule. How do you want to be treated if something goes wrong? And like I said to my dad, who was Mr. Service, I could tell you, I said, I cannot, I'm going to use your name like I knew you at the time. I cannot call Mark a liar. If Mark says I have this problem and we didn't notice it, I have to take his word for it. Because if I'm wrong, what kind of person am I? Yeah. So that's why we do it that way. Do we get taken advantage of? Yes, we do. Yes, we do. There are certain characters we've dealt with in the past, whether it's customers or builders or what have you, that, and luckily it's a small percentage, that sniff us out and they're like, hey, but truly it's a policy that will never change as long as this family owns this company.
Yeah, that's a lesson that we learned too from working with you. We've done the same thing at Five Cat, that if there's an issue, even if it's not really our fault, but it's something that we should have flagged, I don't even push back. I just resolve that issue. I either work to fix it there's been times where I've paid for it. Just to make sure that issue doesn't become a crisis, that just make it go away. It's worth it, because then you get another job and you get another job and you get another job. And that payment that you may have paid to make the problem go away is nothing compared to the amount of money that you make on the multiple jobs that you get because of the relationships you reinforce.
Right. I'll give you an idea. People are like, You talk like you guys never make a mistake. I said, no, that's not true. I talk like we've got the strictest quality control that we've seen in the industry. But that being said, I had a designer here, great guy, great designer, made a mistake, and the customer's refrigerator was not going to work in that layout. I bought the refrigerator because they couldn't return it to the store. They said, no, it's because the client had the cabinetry in storage for 9 months. So they went to put in the refrigerator. They said, that doesn't swing open because of this design. And they said, now we can't return the refrigerator. We got to go out and buy a brand new one. And I said, well, I'm embarrassed. It's clearly our mistake. Would you be happy if I bought that refrigerator off of you, so you didn't have to, because they're telling you can't return it. And then you're free to buy a new refrigerator. And they said, you would do that? And I said, yeah, it's my fault. It doesn't work. So, believe it or not, my folks ended up with a refrigerator because they remodeled their kitchen. So, there's always,
there's always a solution.
Yeah. And, that's a rare instance, but, there probably aren't a lot of custom cabinet makers in this country that would buy refrigerators, So, but once again, it's not about, what we did for somebody. It's about how we operate and what our process is.
Yeah.
I will tell you, I know it's different working in an office environment, but the one thing I didn't talk about is safety. if you work in a woodworking shop, if safety isn't a top priority, you're not going to keep quality employees. That's all there is to it. So when I talk about making quality the number one focus, really quality is the number two focus. Safety is number one, because if you don't have a safe shop, you know, God forbid. So I don't want to overlook that. I know safety isn't the same concern for an architect working in an office. Not that he's not concerned about safety, but they don't have the same things that you could run into that could be a real problem.
It's definitely not. It's not the same. Absolutely, we don't have open. You know, we don't have saws in our office.
Right.
But I would say that especially more recently, it's become more aware. We've become more aware of the hazards of being in an office, just from sitting all day. That if you're sitting from 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night and not getting up, over the years that starts becoming a problem where it becomes a health issue, and you have carpal tunnel syndrome, and those are things that are becoming issues in offices that we weren't really aware of before. And that's something that if you are looking at safety in your office just as much as looking at safety in a workshop, those are the things that we should be addressing with our staff.
Yeah, I will tell you, and that's an excellent point. Right now, I'm standing at my desk because I bought one of the desks that goes up and down.
Yeah.
I went to all of the people in my office and said, if you want one, I will buy one for you. I've had people in here that said, boy, this mouse isn't working. I spend a lot of time like drafters, CAD designers, that say, boy, I'm... You know, my wrist is sore. I say, well, let's do a little ergonomic study and make sure that you've got the best mouse for the job. One of the things that and you mentioned it quite clearly. And a lot of people think, oh, safety means preventing an accident. It's really about preventing an incident. Carpal tunnel is an incident.
Yeah.
So those are things that if I'm running a firm like yourself, those are things I have to be aware of and say, how can I prevent those? Especially in my case, I've got people that have worked for me for 20, 30 years. And if you're doing repetitive stuff out on the floor, your body parts can wear out.
Right.
My last two claims were for shoulder surgery for somebody that sprayed for me for over 20 years. So what did we do? We said, okay, we've got to find a way to minimize this. And we put in a new finishing line last December. So it's the never-ending quest to make sure that you minimize the hazards or the incidents, and in your case they may be different, but they're still there.
Yeah. So I would say that from what I'm hearing from you, safety first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then quality.
Yep.
Then teams, focusing on the people, which include gain sharing and giving them the power to make the decisions.
Yep.
And obviously, sort of overlaying everything, are systems that sort of allow these things, whether they're documented or just internally communicated, those systems clearly help you achieve those things. Are there anything else that you changed to be more successful?
Well, I think when we move to selling direct, you know, in the real world, I don't, you know, anything you buy, you go to a store and the store has certain costs that they've got to cover to deliver that product to. And in retail cabinetry, you know, we'd sell it for, you know, whatever, 50 cents on the dollar to the dealer, and they'd sell it at, you know, 75 to 85 cents on the dollar, 100 cents on the dollar if it was in one of the more expensive rent districts. But in our case, when we sold direct, we could be more cost competitive than if we had dealers. And as long as we could do it in an efficient way, it allowed us to have more on the bottom line. And we went from being a company that had massive turnover to a company that has turnover in the single digits, and we're one of the highest paying companies in our area. Our retention is huge. It didn't happen without selling direct, because we had to be able to get a manufacturing markup, which there really isn't one, and get a retail markup. So between the two of those, if we could do those efficiently, then it gave me a chance to make more as a company so I could share more with my employees. And that was critical to us. We just had to find a better way to do it because we could have done the other things, but we wouldn't have been as successful if we were selling through the dealer network. Here we completely control all aspects of the costs. So
yeah, and that's definitely something architects can learn from as well. There are many design build architecture firms that design it and then build it. And the reason they're doing that is to be able to have that quality control and that customer service, the ability to have very top customer service all the way through to the very end.
Right.
Because so often architects lose that relationship during construction when it's not even in your own control, that something happens during construction and then the client gets upset about the whole process and you get thrown in with that.
Right. Right. That's a hard place to be. We get to avoid more of that when we handle as much of the process as we do. I mean, we a lot of custom cabinet makers, they'll buy drawers, they'll buy doors.
Yep.
We do everything with rare exception in this building because I don't want to call you and say, yeah, Mark, I'm sorry about this, but the door company screwed up on the doors. So kitchen's going to show up and half the doors are going to be missing. If we can take care of it, we do it ourselves. And we found that as long as we're good at it, and it comes from having the best crew on the planet, which I'm blessed to have, then our problems are really minimized. So
Brian, thank you very much for being with me here today. It's been very eye-opening. I've learned a lot. I love hearing sort of the behind the scenes at Crown Point. So thank you for opening up the back door and letting us see in a little bit and on what you're doing.
Hey, my pleasure. I appreciate you listening to the story.
You're up in Claremont, New Hampshire, right?
I'm in Claremont, New Hampshire, and I'll tell you what we're doing. We're just at the risk of sounding like a commercial. We are going to start an architects program where they can come up and get continuing education units. We'll be doing presentations on period design, working with cabinet makers, that kind of stuff. That's more generic. It's not Crown Point specific, and they get a chance to tour the facility. And it's we'll bring in guest speakers that will also provide more continuing education units. And we're going to launch that in early 2016. And we're very excited about that. So if anybody's looking for it's a tremendous, tremendous operation up here. If you came through it, you'd be really impressed once again, because of the crew I have.
Yeah. And so. I was going to mention that you're also available for tours, that if anybody wants to stop by the Crown Point factory in Claremont, you always welcome us in and give us a tour to see how it's done.
Yeah. We've had architects, we've had homeowners, that are working with architects that we say, you know, if you're going to make the trip, because for some of them, they're like, you know, 4 hours up, 4 hours back, tour that's a long day. We say, come up, we'll put you up at the Common Man Inn on our dime so that you don't have to drive back and forth in one day. We're happy to do it. It's a great little inn and relaxing, you know, bring your wife, bring your husband, have it a romantic getaway, tour the facility and then head back. And I'll tell you, we do it almost every day here and people love it.
Well, that sounds like a good deal. I may take you up on that.
I would love to have you do it.
Yeah. I'll just have to wait for the leaves to turn because it doesn't get much better than New Hampshire in the fall.
Well, in all honesty, they're a little late this year. I'm looking out the window and trees that are normally started to full bloom in color are still pretty green. So yeah. Probably, I would say 2 weeks from now would be just about perfect.
Okay. You're found on the internet at crown-point.com.
That's correct. Crown-point.com.
And you are on Facebook at facebook.com/ Crown Point Cabinetry. You're also on Houzz and you're on Twitter and you guys are everywhere. So if anybody wants to contact you, that's a good place to start. Is there any place, if they wanted to contact you directly, is there a way to contact you directly?
My desk line here is 603-542-3388, or you could just get online and on the general info say, hey, I got a question for Brian. And I tell people, don't ask for Mr. Stoll, there are three Mr. Stolls here, my brother, my son, and myself. And there's only one real Mr. Stoll, and that's Dad. So ask for Brian. Yeah. So happy to talk to him.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for sharing your knowledge here today at the Entree Architect Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
If you like this episode and you want to leave a review, you could just go to iTunes at entrearchitect.com/iTunes. You can subscribe there. You can leave a star review, or you can just leave a couple of nice messages, or not so nice messages. If you don't like what I'm doing, let me know. You can do that as well. I just want some feedback. So go to entrearchitect.com/iTunes and let me know what you think. But even more important than that, if you don't want to do that, just take this episode, entrearchitect.com/episode93, and email it to a friend. That I would be indebted to you forever. Just do that. Just share it with a friend. Share it on social media. Share it through email. Because I'm working for you, and I can't get this going, and I can't get more people listening, and we can't be an influential force if the world doesn't know we exist. So share away. entrearchitect.com/episode93. And I want to encourage you to share what you know. Go invite 4 or 5 of your architect friends out for coffee or lunch, and do that every month. Organize a mastermind group. If you don't know what a mastermind group is, search it on Google, search it on YouTube, and learn what a mastermind is, and go organize one. And you then go share everything you know. Share everything you know. Talk about everything. Everybody talks to me about fees and how they don't know how much everybody else is talking. Go organize a group and share what you know, and then you'll know. Complete show notes and a direct link to download this episode may be found at entrearchitect.com/episode93. Ooh, we're coming up on 100. 7 more episodes to 100. I have no idea what I'm going to do to celebrate 100, but that's going to be a big, big day. So I hope you've been here since number 1. Actually, number 0. There's an intro episode. So actually, I've done 94 of these babies, and I love every single one of them, and I will continue doing them as long as I can. So my name is Mark Arlepage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. Go share what you know. Go share what you know, and I'll see you next week.